each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and I am joined today by my co-host, Loretta Freilich, a former criminal prosecutor for the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, and we are happy to be here with you on Winds of Change. We have a terrific show lined up for you today, a guest we feel very, very grateful to have been able to book. And before we get to him, Loretta, how was your weekend?
Well, my weekend was fabulous, Mayor.
Oh, but wow. You are perky.
What I'm still burning about is the president calling out the Supreme Court in his State of the Union. You and I are both lawyers. You and I know the way you want to say something kind of snotty to the judge you're in front of is, you know, you lead with all due respect, Your Honor, I think we may have a differing of opinions,
right,
and then you state your case.
Yeah.
You don't threaten them. And I was appalled at his conduct.
And to use God's name in the course of doing that, I think, it was really shocking. I mean, we all know he's pro-abortion. He's receives millions of dollars in campaign donations from abortion providers and abortion sources. So he's very much entangled with the abortion industry. But again, to threaten sitting judges just takes it to a level entirely inappropriate. And in fact, I saw a really good op-ed over the weekend from, I want to say it was Justice Brennan's former clerk, one of them, who said, I am of the mind now that the justices should no longer attend the State of the Union address.
Well, I agree with them.
Yeah.
I wish they had stood up and walked out.
They should have, yeah. And I think Justice Roberts, I mean, what he was trying to do was to delegitimize the court's opinion.
Absolutely.
In Dobbs. And maybe for half of the chamber, he might have done so. But I just think he's a lawyer. He should know better.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's if he had a cognitive brain cell functioning.
Yeah,
but,
just,
you know, Mary, we have all, as lawyers, we have all been in front of really bad judges and really bad judges that maybe we want to call out. But, you know, you save that for your coworker in the office that I can't believe they ruled this way.
Right.
But never stand like he did in front of them and call them all out.
Well, and trying to influence a future opinion.
Exactly.
Is essentially what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And telling, you know, and then I saw some interviews with him afterwards where he said, well, I just, you know, I think they're wrong. You're not considered a legal scholar by anybody, you know, even people just fresh out of law school. So please don't embarrass yourself further. The whole thing was just atrocious and very unbecoming of the office that he holds.
Yes.
And I was really embarrassed by him. So,
I was embarrassed as a lawyer.
I was as well. No, I mean, that was just conduct unbefitting, not just the president of the United States, but of a member of the bar. And
exactly.
I think, frankly, if it had been one of us, we'd be up for some kind of disciplinary. I mean, maybe not disbarment.
Oh, my
but we'd
gosh.
Be up for
we'd have an ethics violation in our future that would require
at least
representation.
Somebody, yes, exactly. Somebody would file an ethics violation against us. And
yes.
I think entirely reasonable for anybody to do so. So I don't even know if he keeps his license current, but anyway. But you know, we need to table the State of the Union,
yes,
because I do think that's going to take up a whole hour, and I don't want to take 1 second away from the guest we have coming up.
Yes,
now, who is Francis Mayer, who I have had the great privilege of knowing for many years. He was the executive assistant to Archbishop Charles Chaput, both when he was in Denver, the Archdiocese of Denver, and then later in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. And Fran has written a wonderful new book, which I would highly recommend to all of you listeners, especially as Lent is starting to wrap up and you're looking for some things to meditate upon in terms of your life of faith and your participation in the church. It's called True Confessions, Voices of Faith from a Life in the Church. It has a wonderful introduction by Archbishop Emeritus Charles Chaput, who was the former Archbishop of Philadelphia. And it's published by Ignatius Press. And Fran, do we have you there on the line? Okay. All right. We've got some technical difficulties, but we are, we'll have Fran on the line shortly. So, Loretta, let's go back to the State of the Union.
Okay.
And, okay, so tell me what were your other impressions of it?
That it was so political, that it was a political speech, that it was a campaign speech. You know, the State of the Union is supposed to, I think, in my opinion, tout the greatness of our nation, show where we're going, show the areas in which we're taking corrective measures, honor our military, you know, acknowledge the good things.
Yeah.
But all we had were all these guests that all have something to do with abortion and, you know,
other strange
in vitro fertilization.
We'll discuss that case at length, I think, next week, too, because that really got misrepresented in the press. But, you know, as Ari Fleischer tweeted out, that wasn't a State of the Union address. That was a campaign speech.
It was.
So it didn't do what a State of the Union address is meant to do. But we have, I think, overcome the technical difficulties that befell us earlier. And I believe we've got Fran Mayer on the line now. Fran, are you there? Okay, Fran, I'm sorry. We keep having difficulty connecting. So let me try again. I am going to see if we can find an alternate way of
all right,
contacting.
Mary, while you work on that,
okay.
I just want to also say I was so upset by the speech. It took an entire retreat on Saturday.
Oh, good heavens.
Yes, to get me back in my Lenten mode. And I attended a wonderful retreat with Father Daniel Maria Klimek. And Father Daniel Maria is the author of For the Love of Mary. And it's a beautiful book. He gave a all-day retreat. It was just lovely. I was held out at the parish of St. Isaac Joe's, and Legata sponsored it.
Oh, nice.
Yes, it was so lovely.
How do you hear about all these things? Because I feel like every weekend you've been to some relic display or you've been to a retreat. No, I'm serious because like some of these are very interesting. And I'm thinking, I just, you know, would love to know where it is that you find out about. Is there a Facebook page, or is there a Twitter feed, or is there some, how do you find out? Are they in your parish bulletin?
No. I think God is so very good to me, Mary, and he blesses me by friends who send me in that right direction.
Yeah.
You know, just like you got today's guest for us to come on because you've known him so long and so well.
And third time's a charm, and I believe he is now on the line with us. Fran, are you there? Okay. We are having some kind of technical difficulty. You know, I think we should go to a break now.
Great idea.
And then why don't we go to a break? And then when we return, we will hopefully have Fran Mayer with us. Please don't go away because he's going to be a wonderful guest. We're going to have a terrific conversation about his new book, True Confessions, Voices of Faith from a Life in the Church. Stand by.
For 150 years, St. Stanislaus Koska Academy has been an oasis that builds a moral foundation for your child based upon Catholic faith, virtue, and valor, along with strong academic preparation for children pre-kindergarten through eighth grade. Here's how you can help St. Stanislaus Koska Academy and have a good time. Come out and play for St. Stan's Academy during the annual Casino Night Fundraiser, Saturday, April 25th at 6 p.m. Enjoy casino games, food, drinks, and great music. all while helping to support St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy, Saturday, April 25th at 6 p.m. Now, you must be 21 or over. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy is located at 1255 North Noble in Chicago. That's one block north on Noble, off Division, just off the Kennedy. You are listening to
Mary Fiorito
and
Loretta Freilich
on Winds of Change. You can help save a life by praying for an end to abortion in your community. Find a 40 Days for Life vigil nearby. Visit 40daysforlife.com, 40daysforlife.com, to help save a life.
And then next, we're back.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich. And I think now, finally, after quite an adventure, I think we finally now have Fran Mayer on the line. Are you there, Fran?
I sure am, Mary.
Okay, thank you. I was thinking you were like pranking me or hanging up on me or something. But this is not very nice.
I have a huge grin on my face listening to the two of you. It's wonderful.
Oh, good. Tap dancing.
And now, let's see, what'd you have for lunch? Okay, so I'm sorry. I'm disappointed because this has now cut into a lot of what our juicy conversation was going to be about here, Fran. So,
Fran, you should know that's really how I feel about the State of the Union. I wasn't pretending, stalling for time.
Yeah, that was, we owe the president the respect that is due to his office. But I know this isn't part of your book, but if we could just dovetail for a second, what were your impressions? Did you watch it, first of all? I suppose I should ask you.
Yeah, I thought the whole thing was, I have a pretty dark sense of humor, and I enjoyed part of it because I thought it really reflected the condition of the republic right now. I mean, I think you used, Mary, in your comments that it was appalling what he did, and it just was. I mean, it's like Caesar. It was like something out of, first century BC Rome. I mean,
are you thinking, like, is this like Don Corleone? Nice job you got there, John Roberts. It would be a pity if something happened to one of your kids. Like, that's what you, I thought, dear Lord, what is he saying?
Or Mother Cabrini the governor of New York when she tells him at the end of the movie, nice job you got there, governor. It'd be a shame if the Italians didn't vote for you.
But I think in relation to our conversation here today, and I really did, it was a wonderful listening to two lawyers talk about that speech, because I think it does underline one of the expressions of the problems we've got in the country, and it also underlines the importance of the Catholic community having some sort of organic unity and standing up against the kind of direction that the culture is taking.
So, right.
And that was very much in my mind as I was trying to put the book together. So Biden is a perfect example of where assimilation has got us as a Catholic community.
Right. Yeah. And that's a whole nother book, I think, in one sense, Fran. But
Fran, this is Loretta. Can I ask what made you write this book? And how did you choose the population you interviewed?
Yeah, well, Loretta, I wrote it because I could. I mean, I've been doing some version of this for almost 50 years, and I've thought quite candidly. I mean, I've been really increasingly disappointed in the Roman criticism of the Church in the United States, because my experience, both at the popular level in terms of parish life and the bishops that I've known, and I've known an awfully lot of them, has been very positive. I mean, as a former prosecutor, you would know very well the problems in the church. But in my experience, they were, the problems are dwarfed by the goodwill of the people that I've worked with.
And
I've never had a Pollyannish attitude toward anything, candidly, because I know my own character, which is frequently pretty flawed. But I mean, the people, the bishops, the priests, the lay people that I've worked with in the church and in just daily life as Catholics, I've been very positively impressed by. And I thought it was important to say that, because some people are too critical of the church in the United States.
And I have to also say that during Cardinal George's tenure, he was so diligent in watching what was happening and caring for the victims and the priests that were either falsely accused or the victims that were putting forth their claims. And I can honestly say Cardinal George did such a phenomenal job. And I think the sexual abuse scandal is serious. There are legitimate victims. There is also an overtelling of this story in an attempt to make the church look less than loving, less than Jesus.
Right. Right.
And I think we need to acknowledge that because, you know, some very challenging issues were handled so well, at least in Chicago, I believe, by Cardinal George.
Yeah, I had the same experience in my position. I dealt with these directly mm-hmm. for 18 years, these issues, you know,
right.
And my experience both with Archbishop Stafford originally in Denver and then Archbishop Chaput for the next 23 years. I mean, there was a genuine human concern and priority given to the victims.
Yes.
And I think in that regard, one of the guys that I think is useful to read in the book, there's Scott Browning was our attorney for many, many years. He's a good friend, and he handled a lot of our cases. And he's very articulate in terms of the gravity of the problem, but also the fact that it was kind of jumped all over by the media and used to decertify the church as kind of a moral witness in a way that was very cynical.
Yes.
And that was bothersome. That's one of the interviews that I was really pleased with, because the irony, of course, is that Scott's a Methodist. yet he came away from all the decades that he's worked with the Catholic Church is just with nothing but praise for the church. I mean, it's been gratifying.
It's funny because I was the Chicago public schools have a terrifically bad problem with sexual abuse of minors in the schools. And the Chicago Tribune, in fact, did a huge investigative piece that was on the front page. And, I mean, did you hear about it? It just basically disappeared from public view. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of current cases.
Current cases, yeah. And those teachers are all in what they call teachers' jail.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
every day they come to work and go and sit in a desk
and
in a
paid.
Classroom.
While
they get
getting paid and their
and
pensions
nobody
are building up.
Is held accountable.
Right. And then they do move them from school to school. But, you know, I was comparing that to my own experience. I had volunteered to drive the follow car, so I wouldn't even be directly with the kids, the follow car for my daughter's field trip. And I have taken what, I don't know what they called it in Philadelphia, Fran, but we called it the Virtus program, which was the training program.
Yeah.
And I've probably taken Virtus so many times because it was mandatory, you know, and I was there 28 years, so probably, 20 of that? It was mandatory for all of us every year, and we had to always go to I could teach the darn thing at this point. I mean, it's hilarious. Mm-hmm. And I was told, because I hadn't watched, the three most recent videos.
Right.
I couldn't drive the follow car.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, now this is getting absurd. Weren't you, Loretta, told that you couldn't teach a CCD class or something?
She
was prosecuting the sex crimes, and she said she wasn't a safe person. Oh,
not even gosh. Prosecuting them at this point. I'm the one who goes to the interview. I worked in the sex crimes division, and I was the one who went to the interview, met with the woman who would question them, the police officer, the social worker, anybody. And I was the one that said yay or nay on the charges. And then what happens is I try to teach a class in a CCD, a catechism class in our parish school, and they told me no, I hadn't done Virtus training.
It is bizarre.
And I suppose that should be a comforting thing for parents to hear, is that nobody gets past whoever the gatekeeper is for these Virtus things. Nobody gets past it. And we may be going a little overboard. It might be something of a what they call an overcorrection. But Fran, you and I both lived through all of this within the church together. And, you know, there would be sometimes people would say to me, how do you stay working for this place? Because they would have this perception that there were somehow people of bad will who were putting predators ahead of children, that sort of thing, right? And I remember how I first virtually met you, and it was I had read an article you wrote about your son who has Down syndrome,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
how he was one of the most vulnerable populations for sexual abuse because of his disability. And I showed it to Cardinal George, and he said, oh, that's that Fran Meyer guy. You know, he works for Archbishop Chaput. That's why Archbishop Chaput's things are always so good, because of Fran Meyer. He said, you should read him more. So I started following you. We hadn't actually met then. But that was a very tough time to sort of go through as someone who was in the positions that you and I, you know, held for our respective bishops. How did you find that personally, just as a dad, and especially a dad of a special needs son? Did you ever find a time where you had to think, should I keep on with this job?
No,
am I
never,
doing the right
never.
Thing? Yeah, I didn't either, but I just wanted to get your sense of it.
Yeah, no, I just, because I knew, you know, Sue is, Mary, you know Sue, I mean,
yes.
she was a Catholic school teacher for 40 years, and she was recruited a couple of times to go into the public schools. And she declined because she really wanted to be in a Catholic environment. But that led to a lot of discussions about teaching as a profession. And so I always knew, through Sue, the level of the problem in the public schools, which are frequantly worse than anything that happened in the Catholic educational system.
Right.
You know, or
absolutely.
And so, plus, my patron saint is Augustine. So I have a pretty dark view of human nature, and the dark comes along with the light. You have to deal with both, and I think in my experience of the church throughout my life has been overwhelming, as I said earlier, overwhelmingly positive. And that's not, again, I'm very conscious of the damage that's been done by priests who were predators. I'm not diminishing that at all,
right.
Particularly because of our son. And we also have, like, three of our 11 grandkids have special needs. So, I mean, something that's really on our mind a lot. But when you look at the fact that the church is populated and run by human beings, and human beings are pretty flawed creatures, I mean, we look pretty good compared to just about any other institution on the planet right now. So I strongly believe that. And to get back to Loretta's original comment about why I did it, I mean, I did it because I 50 years in, or almost 50 years in, I mean, I love the church more than when I started. And I started wondering if I was going to lose my faith because of what I would see. What I saw was better than I ever expected to see.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I wanted to capture the views of bishops on one hand, because they, you know, run the operation on some level.
Sure.
And then the people in the field, you know, religious deacons and priests, and then mainly lay people. And it's really the contrast and the similarities among those three groups is very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's just a lot of questions that I had that I wanted people to understand. I mean, why do donors who spend a life earning money give it away? What are they looking for in terms of, you know, and what makes a successful ministry successful? And what do new immigrants think about the country? I mean, there's so many categories that, I mean, I could have gone on for another 200 or 300 interviews, but at some point your brain just kind of fries and you've got to stop, you know. So.
And what was interesting, you talked to not only Catholic lay people, but also lay people of other denominations to get their input. And what inspired you to do that? Because I thought that is a really smart thing to do, to get a clear and complete picture of the churches in the United States.
Yeah, well, particularly the interview that I did with Carl Truman, who's one of our colleagues, Mary, as you well know. I mean, Carl and Katrina are good friends. He's a ordained Presbyterian minister. And very convicted in his branch of Christianity, you know. But to get a view of what other people on the outside think of us can be useful in terms of understanding what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. And so that was an interlude somewhere in the middle of the book that I found interesting in terms of okay, what do other people think of us as we go through these experiences? So, you know, it turned out to be, as I indicated, Scott Browning is a Methodist, and Carl is a Presbyterian. There are a couple of other people in there, I think, as well, that just have a different perspective, but a respectful one. Something that, I mean, they're people who admire the effort that the church has done to live up to her mandate, both in terms of fixing problems and witnessing Jesus Christ, which is what it's all about at the end of the day, you know.
Yes.
So,
can I ask you, Fran, and I'm just going to put a disclaimer out there. I also serve on the board of the National Board of Pentecost Today, USA. Mm-hmm. Did you ever consider addressing members of the lay movements in this book? And is that like going to be your follow-up book? Because the book is brilliant, but it also gives me a lot to pray for the church.
Yeah, and yeah, a lot of the people, are members of lay movements in one mm-hmm. form or another.
Sure.
Whether I identify them as such, I'm not sure, but I know that several of the people that I interviewed, the lay people, talked about the and priests too and bishops talked mm-hmm. about the importance of. You know, the future really lying in the hands of the lay apostolic movements. That's where the energy in the church is.
Amen.
You know? And because they have the freedom to be inventive. And Archbishop Chaput was particularly sensitive to that because he came out of the Capuchin reform movement within the Franciscan community, which itself began, as he indicates, that began as a lay ministry, not a clerical one. Mm-hmm. You know, so he had a particular sympathy with the lay movements, which is why Denver became a magnet for that stuff. And I don't belong to a movement. I went through the Curcio and were very affected by it. But I have a huge number of friends who are either in CL, you know, Communion
right.
Liberation, or Opus Dei, things like that. That are sources of life in the church.
And
I think that should be underestimated. That's really a powerful force for good in the church.
Amen. And, you know, just I would also recommend that you just look into Encounter. Father Matthias Thielen is doing such an incredible job with satellite classrooms all over the United States and the world. And I'm telling you, people are engaging so much in Encounter. They are, you know, understanding their identity as Catholics and then doing the things that Jesus did, which is evangelizing their sphere of influence. And it really, someone as brilliant as you to put your analysis to, you know, a movement like that would really be beneficial to the church.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. As soon as my brain recovers from the last 103 interviews, that may take a bit. Well, at my age, but I mean, I think the point that you're making is really good.
Yeah, you know? And Fran, you know, one of the other great contributions you're making here is because, you know, you like me worked for. I was at the Archdiocese 28 years. How long were you between your two positions?
27 years in the diocese.
But then, you had additional time. Yeah. But then you had additional. So we were almost there at the exact time frame. But then you had additional time as a Catholic journalist.
Yeah, I was editor in chief of the National Catholic Register for 15 years when it was owned by the Frawley family in California.
Wow. Okay.
Which was another example of lay apostolic witness. I mean, the Frawleys were lay people and successful in a variety of ways, but Jerry Frawley was my boss as the publisher, and she was really a committed laywoman who wanted the Register to be as effective as it could be. So
right.
I mean, that was all lay people,
right? And but part of one of the benefits, I guess, of being with the church for such a long time is, first of all, you know, just your knowledge base is so much more significant than anybody else, you know, would be, because one of my former supervisors, Father Ray Baumhart, who was a Jesuit, who was the former president of Loyola University in Chicago, said, you know, the longer you are with an institution, the more valuable become, not less valuable. And he really had a PhD from Harvard's, a degree from Harvard's Business School and a PhD in something in business organization or something like that. So he was a terrific administrator, but he felt very strongly about trying to keep good people on long term. That was one of his ways of, but one of the other things that comes from that is that you, first of all, you get to know other bishops well, you get to know them personally. And they get to trust you because they know that you know how to keep a confidence. They know that you know why it is important to keep certain confidences. And I don't mean about, you know, keeping bad behavior secret. I mean about keeping private things private, right? And about being able to be more effective because you're seen as a trustworthy source and a trustworthy, you know, person to advise if that comes necessary. So you had, I think, is it 30 different bishops speak to you for this book?
I had 30 bishops that I interviewed. Yeah,
right.
And there were actually I got a beautiful note today from one of the bishops I had interviewed, and he'd read the book. I've gotten a couple of letters like that, which were pretty gratifying. But they're very different personalities, 25 different states.
Right. Some urban, some rural.
I can't believe I did it.
I know. I was marveling at that. You know,
is there one theme that runs through what every bishop told you?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of themes. One of them is a real confidence and hope in young people, because there may be fewer Catholics, but the ones that are sticking around and the ones that are young and committed are really first-rate people. That's one theme. That's one of the good themes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The other theme is a real apprehension around the direction of the country and the need to separate ourselves mentally from the impulse to assimilate too quickly and too deeply. I mean, the one of the things that we need to recover is a sense of distance critical distance from the culture, not separation, because we have an obligation to be politically involved, for example, and try to make publicly involved and try to use our faith to sanctify the culture. But we need to get over that 100-year stretch where we were just doing everything we could to prove that we were good Americans and
mm-hmm.
assimilate. You know, because there are things about the United States that, as it currently stands, that we really shouldn't want any part of, and you know that better than I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and one of them was giving the State of the Union speech the other
night.
You know?
Right.
I mean, that kind of assimilation is just a perfect example of how sticking with an institution too long cannot be good.
Well,
because I
take your point. Right, there's a certain point where you start to become a liability. Right.
Yeah.
Well, and also, too, I don't know about you, I love the Rosary. I love Blessed Mother. She has been a stay in my faith. And to see Joe Biden just hold one in times of crisis, it's more aggravating than it is consoling.
Well, it's more like a theater prop with him, frankly.
Yes. Well, it is. It's an act of hypocrisy, and I wouldn't want to go into eternity with that particular burden.
Right.
You know? I mean, he's... he's really a problem. I mean, when you look at the two men, I mean, when you look at Trump and when you look at Biden, I mean, both on some level, for me anyway, I'm only speaking for myself and Sue Ann, I mean, both of them are kind of an embarrassment to the political system.
Right.
And that's that's the other issue. And the both of you being attorneys, I think we have a particular sensitivity to this. The country was constructed to be a certain kind of legal mechanism. It was invented out of whole cloth, and it doesn't work if you don't have mature, thinking, intelligent citizens. And the entire nature of American culture right now is to turn us into something very different, which is kind of unthinking consumers.
Yes.
And just all appetite all the time, all desire all the time.
Yeah.
In terms of long-term cultural and political health of a country, that's really dangerous.
Yeah, and well, you know, one of the things that used to make me really incensed after it became sort of a pattern was the moniker that the Catholic left media tried to assign to your former boss, Archbishop Chaput, and that was culture warrior, that he's the culture warrior bishops. Can you... we've never actually talked about this, and I don't know why, after all the years we've known each other, but first of all, it's just, you know, it's such just a drive-by comment, right, with no substance to it. But what do you make of that particular angle that they're taking? I always kind of find it more interesting to look to see Why is the person saying that using that particular? I think it says more about them than it does about the person they're saying it about.
Oh no,
right?
Mary, I think you're exactly right. Number one, on some level, right? The culture war is the nature of human life. I mean, you're constantly struggling to make the culture either better or worse. And so, on one level, being called a culture warrior is simply stating the truth about what it means to be a Christian, because Christians are engaged in permanent conflict against evil and trying to convert a culture. Okay, so, but that's not how the word's used. The word's used in the same way that people get use words like, you know, homophobia or Islamophobia or you're a hater. I mean, frequently that's just an expression, a transference of their own resentments onto the people that they want to decertify. And that was clearly the case with Shapu. I mean,
Was it because he was pro-life? Was it because he opposed same-sex marriage? What was the genesis? When did that particular thing start with Archbishop Shapu?
I think it started fairly early because he had no problem expressing his opinion strongly and defending it well.
Right.
And that's dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, when you're part of a bureaucratic identity like an institution like the church, I mean it runs on a certain kind of deference and political discretion that doesn't welcome honesty. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, if you didn't like honesty, you didn't work for Shapu because,
right. I mean,
because I never saw him in all the years I worked for the Archbishop. And I really love him. I mean, I admire him enormously. I never saw him lose his temper.
Wow.
Not once.
Oh, interesting.
You know?
Wow.
And I never saw him, raise his voice inappropriately. I mean, I never saw that. But he was alarmingly honest sometimes when you didn't want to hear it, and that makes people irritated.
Right.
And he didn't. I think the other thing too, Mary, and this is the second part of answering your question. When he said he was going to do something, he did it, and he did it without any regret.
Right.
And that's another thing that's not very frequent in the church, where people may have very good intentions and may say they're going to do something and then be defeated by the bureaucratic nature
apparatus. I found that myself quite a few times.
It's just easier to kick everything down the road.
Right.
And of course, that results in a place like Philadelphia in 2011, where everything had been kicked down the road and we had a $300 million debt. I mean, it's just he didn't do that. If he said he was going to do something, he would do it.
Right.
And he didn't take on fights that were just stupid. He picked his arguments very carefully, but then when he engaged, he really meant it. And that was intimidating to people who didn't like what he had to say.
Well, as you were, you know, just as reflecting back on your career and also when you were doing the interviews for this book, I mean, this is really funny because I actually had a call today from a friend who is attempting to engage with a particular member of the hierarchy. And, you know, he was telling me, well, I went through this person and then, you know, I got an email address and sent it to this person. And I said, you know, if I could offer you some advice, please don't go around his staff, because you may get through to him and you may get the thing that you want agreed upon. But then it'll get kicked back to the staff and they've already been kept out of the loop. That doesn't create a good relationship. I can't tell you the number of people would say, well, I got the cardinal's number and I called him So he told me to tell you to do what? And I'm like, well, unless he tells me to do it, I'm not going to do it. And I don't report to you. I report to him. That had to be for me one of the most frustrating things, is that people didn't understand that people like you have authority. And the Archbishop gave that authority to you, and they should be. And it always, I just find personally, it's better to work through the people that have been entrusted with that work. Sometimes, I guess, they can be doorkeepers, but oftentimes they're really just trying to help their boss do the right thing. When you were interviewing the 30 bishops that you did, and I want to point out to listeners, all of the bishop interviews are anonymous. So you can, that would be an interesting game to play, to go through and see if you can figure out. I think I have two of them, Fran. I'm pretty sure. But I'm glad that you gave them that anonymity so that they could speak frankly, because I think
that was on me. I didn't give them the option. I insisted on it.
That enabled them to relax and
be frank. Look, you know better than anyone, Mary, that almost anything they say that's identified can easily get misrepresented.
Right. Can or will be used against you. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
To use the legal terminology.
So I just wanted to get past that, and I think the guys appreciated it, and that's why they were as frank as they were.
Was there anything when you were speaking with them that surprised you, even after all of your years of service? No. So you had all this you had heard before.
Yeah, some of them were more articulate than others, and some of them had particular things that they were focused on. There's one interview, really, that moved me deeply about a guy who has a poor diocese and made the point that some of the harshest treatment he's gotten is from fellow bishops.
I mean, interesting.
That was one. There was another one that clearly. He's a really good guy in kind of a mixed urban-rural diocese. He was talking about his experience of debriefing when he was just a new bishop, debriefing the exorcist of his diocese and just the hair-raising stuff.
And then
There was another one which I really touched me. I mean, there was a guy who was an auxiliary, and he was talking about how, when you're an auxiliary, you're learning the ropes, but the buck doesn't really stop with you. When you become the ordinary, it's like you stop being a human being on some level.
Right. Reading that. That's so true, isn't it?
It is. It's like you're the embodiment of the institution and people. You're no longer a person in a sense. You're the bishop.
Right. You're a title. You're not. And so people, like if they, for example, we would often get invitations to weddings, right? And because people wanted the cardinal there, they didn't really know him or really care, I don't think, whether or not. It would be considered, at least it was back in the day, prestigious to have the cardinal present at your wedding, right?
Yeah.
So that has to be, because you do become objectified after a certain point.
Now, Fran, can I ask you, what is it that you want readers to come away with from this book?
I want them to come away from the book with a spirit of hope and also one of realism. I use the example. So let me step back.
Sure.
I want to say that again. If you read the book and you read it the way it was intended to be read, you're not going to come away depressed by it. You're going to come away gratified and feeling like somebody told you the truth about a circumstance.
Okay.
The Sue and I have been married 53 years. It's been a great marriage. It is a great marriage. But it's, what makes a great marriage? Well, number one, a framework of love. Number two, a spirit of trust. And number three, a willingness to be candid and sometimes extremely blunt with each other in terms of telling the truth, because love is always connected to truth.
Amen.
And that's very much the life of the church. I mean, the idea that you really shouldn't criticize anybody in the church is nonsense. I mean, there are things that have to be, lay people have a voice that's a legitimate voice. They should speak up. Now, they have to do it respectfully. They have to respect the office of pastor and bishop. They have to respect one another. But they have to tell the truth, or it's just a big charade.
Right.
And we shouldn't be afraid of doing that, because we're not second-class citizens, as Joseph Ratzinger made clear many times. We're co-equal in the missionary task of the church. And if some leader is not doing his job properly or diverging from what the church has always taught, we have an obligation to say that.
Yes.
Frankly.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe it's just my age now, but I don't see any kind of difficulty with telling the truth as long as it's told honestly. So the point is that if you read this book, I hope, by the grace of God, people will read the book and feel like they got told the truth about the nature of the church in the United States in the third decade of the 21st century.
Right,
And they should be happy. They should be hopeful. But they shouldn't be Pollyannish.
Right.
Because there's a lot of problems.
And that's the beauty of this book, Fran. It's an evangelization tool. It is a wake-up call. It is a learning tool. you know, vessel for people who don't understand how the church bureaucracy works from the inside. You know, sometimes you watch movies about, you know, whether it's The Godfather or anything else that have like these church scenes. I always find myself like laughing at some of them, thinking, okay, that would never happen, and that would never happen. And, you know, these people have these visions of what, you know, a cardinal's office or an archbishop's office looks like, and it's often very, very different from reality. But, well, listen, we are going to go to a break. Frank, can you stay with us until the other side? Of okay, terrific.
Yeah, absolutely.
Listeners, we will be right back. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Frelick on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
For 150 years, St. Stanislaus Koska Academy has been an oasis that builds a moral foundation for your child based upon Catholic faith, virtue, and valor, along with strong academic preparation for children pre-kindergarten through eighth grade. Here's how you can help St. Stanislaus Koska Academy and have a good time. Come out and play for St. Stan's Academy during the annual Casino Night Fundraiser, Saturday, April 25th at 6 p.m. Enjoy casino games, food, drinks, and great music, all while helping to support St. Stanislaus Koska Academy, Saturday, April 25th at 6 p.m. Now, you must be 21 or over. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is located at 1255 North Noble in Chicago. That's one block north on Noble, off Division, just off the Kennedy. You are listening to
Mary Fiorito
and
Loretta Frelick
on Winds of Change. You can help save a life by praying for an end to abortion in your community. Find a 40 Days for Life vigil nearby. Visit 40daysforlife.com, 40daysforlife.com, to help save a life.
And welcome back. Thanks for listening to Winds of Change. Welcome back, Fran. We are joined today by Francis Meyer, the Mayor or Meyer, Fran? Have I been mispronouncing your name all these years?
Mayor. No, it's Mayor.
Mayor,
it's,
okay.
It's a just a family pronunciation, you know, so.
Like the I was a Y.
It's with an I.
Yes,
it's
but it's pronounced like a Y.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's exactly right.
All right, good. Terrific. All right, now I'm glad three quarters into the way of the interview, I've asked you that question. Okay, I want to, this is something I have to say, so many things struck me in the book, Fran, and I'm so grateful again to you for writing it, but this was sort of the money paragraph for me, and it's in the chapter called Here Comes Everybody. I'm a church bureaucrat myself. My colleagues are all good persons. But if we measure ourselves against the goal of bringing souls to Jesus Christ and transforming people with the gospel, well, we just don't do it. At a time when the church leaders seem clueless and walking into the abyss when it comes to understanding the nature and scope of the challenges heading our way, again, we need a countercultural gospel, a whole new intellectual and practical approach to our problems. What gives me hope mainly is the lay movements of the church. And I just don't see the will to renew the institution in its current form. And boy, did that, I felt like that kind of hit me right between the eyes because, you know, I had the privilege of serving as the cardinal's liaison to the lay ecclesial movements. And first of all, I thought the church would probably not exist in the city if it were not for them because they were the ones, some of them, not communion and liberation, but the neo-catechumenal way.
Yeah,
every
yeah.
Lent, they go door to door, Fran, inviting people to come back to Mass during Lent and to come back to Mass for Easter. They do door to door evangelization. And then you have the movements like the Focolari that work with children through their Gen group. And what it made me reflect upon was how, you know, because we had a number of non-Catholic employees, how am I trying to introduce them to the gospel? And do I take into account how my own personal behavior and interactions with others might reflect the church to them?
Yeah, boy, you just opened up a can of worms there.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry.
A good one. I mean, in the sense that what that gentleman said is really one of the money paragraphs in the book. I mean, the job that I did, there was a certain amount of bureaucratic maintenance going on, and that's the tendency throughout the bureaucracy of the church, and it can't last. I mean, I think Archbishop Chaffee says in the long form interview at the end of the book that the Vatican can't continue to operate the way it is simply because the money's not going to be there. Well, that's the case in the church in the United States, too. I mean, all these huge buildings that we've got are really kind of a drag on the emotional endurance of people working for the church. And that we're just going to have to get used to the idea that a lot of that's going away, and that the church in 30 years is going to look very different. Not necessarily worse by any means, but different. And we're just not in the mental state to accept that yet. Well, lay movements are, but we're not.
Yeah, they're already using a new form of evangelizing. And I think it was St. John Paul II who saw the genius in them, right? And then Benedict continued that. I mean, having the Communion Liberation Women serve as his household staff, which he rarely ever gets credit for. I mean, he's the first pope to choose lay women to staff the papal household. And so, but so when you were talking to all of the people you interviewed for this book, clergy and laity alike, I can't imagine the topic of the current papacy didn't come up. And what started out as such a hopeful, exciting time in the church has really kind of become very frustrating for a lot of people, particularly people who I mean, without getting into too many generalizations, would be the most serious practitioners of the faith. They've become incredibly discouraged, while I think simultaneously trying to hold out hope and respect for the office itself. What are some of your reflections on how that, the sort of current situation of things, was being felt by people? How are they, you know, expressing, you know, if they have any frustrations, how are they expressing those to you?
Yeah, well, I want to underline one thing first, that all the bishops that I talked to are faithful guys. I mean, none of them were inappropriate in the way that they talked about.
No one's in open rebellion or calling for the Pope.
Calling
him
like
a fake Pope or whatever.
No, nothing like that. Now, having said that, a number of them pointed out that no one had come to their seminary inspired by Francis. A number of them expressed frustration with his style of leadership, and there was a great deal of feeling of confusion about, you know, why the Holy See seems to have a negative attitude toward bishops in American Catholic life.
Yes, not seem to like the church America.
No, I mean, he clearly doesn't. In fact, one of the one foreign archbishop that I talked to brought that up, that he just clearly doesn't like the United States. Now step back from that for a moment. And why is that the case? Well, I mean, he's Latin American, and the United States has operated in Latin America in ways that are very problematic sometimes.
Right.
And so
we've
done plenty of things that Latin Americans have a right to be frustrated or angry about, but that's separate from one's attitude toward the church in the United States, which produces an enormous amount of resources for the church globally, and has. I had a couple of the lay people that I talked to talk about how the church in the United States is more alive than almost any place else except Africa. We're so busy criticizing ourselves and seeing things falling apart that we don't understand that we're actually in a really good position in many ways compared to the church, for example, like in Europe. You know,
yeah.
I mean, and again, going back to perceptions of Roman attitudes toward the United States, you know, a number of the bishops talked about being baffled at the treatment that the church in the United States has gotten from supporters of the Holy See, spokesmen for the Holy See, and the situation in Germany, which is effectively in schism. You know, I mean, So it's an odd time, and I think there's a disappointment with the lack of understanding of the American environment in the current pontificate that has alienated a lot of people.
Hmm. Fran, what would you say that we as lay people can do in response to your book?
Well, you know what I did was start reading scripture a lot more and going to adoration.
Amen.
You know, I mean, those things. Excuse me one second.
Sure.
I think the things that when people talk about renewing the church. Mm-hmm. I mean, I make this point, and I think in chapter 11 or something, I forget, mm-hmm. that, you know, the Americans have this addiction to committees and big ideas and programs, and we're going to, you know, all get together and turn things around. The only way the church ever gets turned around is through personal conversion. Mm-hmm. And nobody really wants to hear that because it's hard.
Yes.
And it means
I have to turn the TV off.
That's right. Yeah. You know, you have to turn the TV off. You have to actually get up and go to Mass. You have to go to adoration. You have to read scripture. You have to actually pray. You have to work to try to forgive the people that really irritate you. I mean, and those are things that nobody really wants to do. Me too. I don't want to do it. You know, I mean, and so, but that's where it starts. And that's the only thing that we really have power over, but that's the power of the powerless. Like Havel said, you know, I mean, the power of the powerless is simply doing the right thing and refusing to do the wrong thing. And if enough of us do it, we affect other people and they affect other people. And pretty soon you have the beginning of a kind of a cultural renewal. I think the thing that people need to take away from this moment is that I've said this for a decade, and at the beginning people thought I was completely crazy, but I think that they're not thinking that anymore. I mean, we really are living through a new reformation, a new kind of reformation, literally a reformation, sure. a restructuring of the way that we look at the world, the way that we look at what it means to be human. And there's never been a better time on one level to be a Christian because we actually have something to do.
Right. I mean, well, there you go.
You know, I mean, this is a period of time when Christians can actually prove what they mean when they say that they're Catholic.
Right.
And it was very comfortable for a long time, but also when you're comfortable, you don't get a whole lot of credit for going to Mass when you know, it's easy to go to Mass. Yes. When it's not easy to talk about your faith, when it's not easy to worship, when it's countercultural to believe the things
when the
that
FBI
you do.
Will show up at your lawn to arrest
that's
you.
When it matters, and that's when it matters. And people are hungry for that because there's no purpose to American culture.
Yes.
There's no telos to any of this stuff. It's just get more stuff faster and better.
Right.
And that's not a healthy culture.
No.
It's just not a way to live.
Right.
And, you know, Fran, I'm so struck by what you said about going to adoration. We have a new ministry here in Chicago that is rising up, and it is like Fire Fridays, I think they're calling it. 300 students were at the last one. I'm talking high school kids. And given the opportunity to get up from their knees and sit down in a seat, they chose to remain on their knees for an hour in, you know, reverence of the Blessed Sacrament. So you're right. That's what's going to change the world.
Well, Fran,
there's no interior silence. See,
excellent.
If you don't have, because it just, the culture that we have hollows us out with the constant bickering on X and on the internet. And it's an opportunity for us to recover some of that interior silence.
Right. Well, as this music is taking us out, Fran, first of all, thank you for so generously giving this hour to us. Where is the best place for our listeners to get your book?
Well, you get it directly from Ignatius, and I recommend that. But it's also available on Amazon.
Right. So on Amazon or preferred Ignatius Press, and you can just Google Ignatius Press and get a copy of True Confessions, Voices of Faith from a Life in the Church. Fran Mayer, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation.
Thanks very much. God bless you guys.
God bless you too, Fran.
But truth or sit on the fence, can you see? Can you see?